This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. Since the beginning of the pandemic, overdoses have increased monthly across the nation. But a new podcast shows that rehab facilities across the U.S. are exploiting those who come to them seeking help.
At times, I felt so trapped.
This place took a real mental toll on me. I felt like I was a slave there.
It's almost like they tried to literally brainwash you.
To me personally, it was one of the most clever, smartest scams I've ever seen somebody come up with.
This month, Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX launched a new investigation 3 years in the making. American Rehab explores a system that puts its patients through a form of indentured servitude and has its roots in a literal cult. Here to talk us through it is Laura Starcheski, reporter and producer for American Rehab. Laura, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Tim Rowe, who went to Cinecor last year. That's one of the centers profiled in the podcast for a substance abuse disorder. Tim, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Laura, first let's talk about work therapy. What is it exactly?
Work therapy is simply the idea that someone who is seeking treatment for an addiction should be sent to work for no pay or pennies on the dollar as part of their treatment.
We'll get into how widespread this is later, but how many rehabs did you find in your reporting that use this concept of work therapy?
We were able to find about 300 facilities in almost every state who operate with this work-based rehab model. And the minimum number of people that we found going through programs like this every year is 60,000.
Well, the podcast looks into one rehab center in particular called Cinecor. Tim, you were actually a patient there. I want us to listen to a clip from the podcast where we hear your sister Penny talking about what it was like when you were at Cinecor.
So the two times that he did call here, he was only allowed to talk to us on speakerphone. Okay? And somebody was with him. So he was like, oh, yeah, it's great. You know, it's really great. The food's great. You know, he kept saying the food's great. And I'm like, why does he keep saying that?
Tim just didn't sound like himself.
And then he's like, yeah, just check it out on Cinecor. Go check it out online. Well, he was trying to tell us something was going on without them knowing. You know what I mean?
Tim, what was going on for you in this moment?
It's kind of emotional just hearing that again. Because I remember I was very nervous. And I was trying to tell my sister, you know, I wanted her to go online to find out what this place was really about. Because there were rumors going around inside the place about, you know, different things that were being exposed about Cinecor, Medicare fraud, just their practices. I knew that where I was, it wasn't right for me. But in the previous times that I tried to leave before, they would kind of gang up on you and have a rebuttal for everything that I said when I tried to leave. And they just had me unsure of myself.
Well, take us back to the beginning and how you ended up at Cinecor, how you got connected to that place.
Well, originally I was planning on going somewhere far away, and we found a place in Texas through, I don't know, a friend of my sister's. And this place had apparently just been bought by Cinecor, and it was currently being remodeled or something. And they said that they had a bed open at their Baton Rouge location. And my sister asked me, said, what do you think about going to Baton Rouge? I said, that's far enough for me.
What were some of the rules you were introduced to early on when you first arrived?
Their language, certain words, you always had to say thank you whenever someone would say something to you. You'd have to answer back and then say thank you. if you got in trouble for something, you know, ridiculous, like if I forgot to shave that day, or if my hair was too long, or if my shirt was untucked, someone could come up and say something to you about it, and you wasn't allowed to give any reasons, or you just had to say thank you. It was strange.
Did you have to labor while you were at Cinecor without pay?
For the first 30 days, it was orientation. And that was getting accustomed to
Do you need a moment?
To the rules and regulations. I'm sorry, I just got a little emotional hearing that.
It's okay. It's okay. Take a moment, Tim. Take a moment. Laura, how common is this sort of rehab center when we look at the larger landscape of rehab in America?
Well, when our team started looking into rehabs like this about 3 years ago, you know, it started with just one rehab in Oklahoma that was sending participants to work at a chicken plant. And from there, the team found another rehab in North Carolina, sending people to work at assisted living facilities, you know, bathing and clothing elderly residents, and dispensing some of the same medications that they might have had substance issues with. It took us a couple years to come to that tally, to find about 300 different facilities sending people to work with no pay or for pennies on the dollar. And we know that that's just a minimum number, because the majority of the facilities that we reached out to did not want to disclose information about how they operate. And we also know that most rehabs aren't even required to have a license in many states. So there's no list you can go look at to find out how widespread this is. We just had to go facility by facility and find people like you, Tim, who were willing to talk about what they'd experienced. And I just want to say that, you know, Tim, I know you got emotional there, and we've heard that from so many people who've been through these programs, that it really leaves you with psychological scars. It's not only the physical work that you're doing, but it's being made to work without pay and being made to feel that, you know, you're not valued, and in some cases, you know, enduring those kinds of abusive punishments and really psychological difficulties.
Tim, how did you get out of Cinecor?
I ran. I ran out the back door. That day, the police showed up there. I guess my sister had called the police because they wouldn't let me contact my sister anymore. So she had the police go out and check on me, and they asked me if I was okay. But they wouldn't leave me alone in the room with the police officers. They wouldn't leave me alone to have a phone call. They wouldn't leave me alone with the police. It was intimidating.
And so eventually you had to run.
Right, yeah.
Laura, how much do we know about the history of Cinecor and where this place even came from?
Fortunately, now we know quite a bit because our team was able to dig into it. I don't know how much they actually tell participants now, but Cinecor was actually founded back in the late 60s by a man named Luke Austin, who was a kind of wannabe country music singer and con man who had a violent criminal history, and he actually joined a different program called Synanon. That's the cult that you were referencing at the top of the segment. And he modeled Senecor on this other program, Synanon. And so a lot of the rules that Tim was referring to and punishments that are doled out at Senecor actually come from this rehab program that was founded in the late 50s and actually gave birth to a lot of spin-off programs across the country throughout the 60s and 70s when, you know, what we think of as addiction treatment didn't really exist at that time.
Tim, it's clear that your experience at Synecor has left you with some scars. How would you describe how it affected you?
At first, when I left there, I know for at least a couple months, at least, I was really unsure of myself. I was unsure of my thinking. And I guess that's part of the reprogramming of your brain that they do, which is brainwashing, really. But that's not what I went for. I wasn't getting any therapy. Basically, what they were doing, they were teaching me how to live, how to walk, how to talk in that facility, and go to work every day.
We got this message, this tweet from Freedom to be for you, Tim. It says, I am a survivor of labor trafficking. It is okay to be emotional on the air. I'm falling apart too. We will get through this. I am in therapy for major depression and PTSD. Sir, every single thing that you are saying resonates with me. All of it. Hang in there. So that's a message for you,
thank you,
from Freedom to be. Laura, some people who end up in rehab are there because of a court order. Do we know how courts are assessing these facilities?
What we found in our reporting was that courts typically count success when they court order someone to a rehab program as that person not coming back to appear before them in that court. In other words, not being convicted of another crime after they're court ordered to the rehab. That's not a great measure of success, primarily because, you know, that person may have left the rehab and gone on to another county and not been able to get stable and stay in recovery. And, you know, they may just be still living with active addiction. And so the way that courts measure success doesn't tend to correlate with actual recovery from addiction.
Tim, have you gone to any other treatment centers since being at Synecor?
Yeah, about 2 weeks after I left, I found a place in Naples, Florida. It was called the David Lawrence Center. That was the best thing that I'm so glad that I found that place. That they really did a lot for me.
How was that experience different for you?
Well, it was very pleasant being there. They had a swimming pool that you could actually swim in. it was a 12-step based program. That's what I was looking for. That's what that was a real rehab.
You know, Laura, I hear Tim say that was a real rehab. And in your reporting, what did you find was at the core of the disconnect between what's being practiced at places like Synecor and what we know around best practices for treating substance abuse?
Sure. I mean, I think when you look at how rehab centers are allowed to operate across the U.S., there's not a lot of regulation. Many are not required to be licensed. And there's no one there to ensure that they're at minimum keeping people safe and not exploiting them, much less using some of the evidence-based treatment models that we know can help people. There's just no requirement that they do that. And so what that ends up looking like is, you know, our nation's neglect specifically of the opioid crisis means that almost anyone can hang a shingle up and open something that they call a rehab and exploit the participants, and they don't have to fear any federal regulation.
And do you think some of that lack of regulation is connected to the stigma that's attached to substance abuse?
I do. You know, when we looked back at the history of a lot of these programs, a lot of them operated, at least at first, as sort of a fringe movement. And despite the fact that there's quite a bit of scientific research about what works and what doesn't work, there was never any pressure to use proven methods. So some of the rules and punishments that Tim was mentioning and that we've heard about from other participants, you know, there's decades of research showing that those techniques don't help people stay in recovery, and they can even harm them. And yet we still hear about so many rehabs using them, using something that in a lot of places is called attack therapy, where one individual may be surrounded and other participants in the rehab and at Senecor, even staff were encouraged to participate in this, would surround that person and basically tear them down.
We'll hear more about some of these practices after the break. That's Laura Starcheski, reporter and producer for American Rehab. Also with us, Tim Rowe, who went to Senecor last year. Tim, thank you so much for your time today. We're discussing Reveal's new podcast, American Rehab, from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment. Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
Whenever you face a choice, it helps to think like an economist. And this week on Planet Money Summer School, we'll start off our course in economics with a workout for your brain, how to decide what something truly costs. Listen now to Planet Money from NPR.
We're talking about Reveal's new podcast, American Rehab, from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. It explores the use of so-called work therapy within rehab centers across the United States. I'm joined by Laura Starcheski, reporter and producer for American Rehab. I want to bring another voice into the conversation. Shoshana Walter is the lead reporter for American Rehab. Shoshana, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Jen.
So just before the break, we were talking about something called The Game, which is this aggressive approach to group therapy. And there's a description of The Game in the podcast, American Rehab. Let's listen.
It starts with a group of people sitting in a circle.
Now, the group singles out one person at a time, attacks that person, and shatters his defenses. And then the game switches to the next person, and so on it goes, with no professional direction.
Anything I say, what? You will not do.
Really?
Like a little baby.
Really?
I want. You're not a man. Your mouth don't make you a man.
Laura, explain a little bit more about what we are hearing there.
Sure. This so-called therapy, The Game, was a foundational aspect of a treatment program called Synanon that was founded in the late 1950s and was one of the first places that people with opioid addiction could supposedly get treatment and try to curb or stop their use. And the way The Game works is just what you hear. It is a confrontational group therapy designed to tear someone down so that the program could build them back up. And we've seen this therapy carried on almost through an oral tradition from rehab to rehab over the past more than 50 years, to appear in a lot of rehab programs today. It's sometimes called the hot seat at the Senecor Foundation in Louisiana and Texas. It's sometimes called attack therapy.
Shoshana, since we're talking about Synonym, that's the cult that has its fingerprints still in rehab centers today. Can you give us some background on Synonym?
Sure. It was founded in 1958 in Santa Monica, California. It was founded by a recovering alcoholic named Chuck Diedrich. And he basically started it as an informal group for people struggling with substance abuse. Eventually, it came to attract mainly heroin and opioid users. And it became, the first, essentially what is the first drug rehab facility in the United States. At that time, the main mode of thinking about heroin addiction in particular was that there was no cure, that it was a kind of form of psychopathy that could not be cured at all with any kind of treatment. And this was a revolutionary idea at the time, that this group of ragtag users could use confrontational tactics and peer accountability and punishment to get each other sober.
Well, Laura, we heard earlier from Tim, who didn't realize what he was getting into with Synecor. How transparent are these centers about the sort of therapies they use?
I guess on some of their websites, you might see the phrase therapeutic community. That doesn't necessarily mean that any of these kind of shaming and punitive tactics are being used, but Synonym was a therapeutic community and Senecor is a therapeutic community. You might also hear the term behavior modification. And there's not a lot of openness until you walk through the door of a rehab like this, expecting to be cared for and cared about. And instead, you're subjected to techniques that most people have not seen until they encounter them themselves in person. So it's not something that's out there advertised.
Well, as we started off today, there are these different approaches that are used in these centers. We talked about the game, but we were focusing on work therapy. And Shoshana, I want to circle back to that and what you found out about how this work therapy is being used by these centers and the kind of money that's being generated by it.
Sure. Work therapy essentially means that these programs are operating in many cases like temp agencies, unpaid temp staffing agencies, where rehab participants will enter a program for 6 months, up to 2 years, sometimes longer. And the majority of their time is spent working without pay or for very, very little money in the form of a stipend or gift or token payment. They will often work for rehab-run businesses like thrift stores, tree trimming companies, landscaping, daycares. And they'll also work for Fortune 500 companies and for major corporations. At Senecor, go ahead.
Well, how do those relationships between the center and these Fortune 500 companies evolve? How do those come together?
Oftentimes, the rehabs are sending participants to work for subcontractors for some of these large companies. So at Senecor, we found rehab participants who had worked through subcontractors at Exxon, at Shell, at a Walmart warehouse. We also found rehabs running their own temp staffing agencies, where the companies will pay the rehab for the labor, but then none of that payment will actually make it to participants. There's a program outside San Francisco where participants have worked for Williams-Sonoma at their warehouse, for Avalon Bay Communities, which is one of the largest property companies in the United States, doing construction work on apartment complexes. Millions of dollars have gone to the program and into the rehab director's pocket, but those participants have not made a single dime for the long period of work that they do without any pay.
Well, it's also important to point out that some of these jobs can be pretty dangerous as well, right?
Yeah, we found at least three people have died from injuries sustained on the job. At Senecor alone, in the past 10 years, 24 people have been injured. People have broken their backs on the job, have been electrocuted. In Massachusetts, there was a rehab run by Teen Challenge that was running its own car wash. A participant died from burns sustained while on the job. There was another participant in a program in Oklahoma who was tree trimming without any safety equipment or training, and fell from the tree and sustained brain damage from that fall.
Well, we're hearing from you. MJ tweets, how on earth do you need a license to operate, say, a hair salon? Absolutely no disrespect to salons, but not for a rehab, especially if you're taking Medicare, Medicaid money. Unbelievable. And Patty asks, is there a financial incentive to open a rehab center? For example, government funding. What do you think, Laura? Was that part of what you found in your reporting?
I think in general, the appeal of this kind of program, the work-based program, is the money that comes into the program through the companies that hire the workers. But that being said, we did find examples of rehabs like Senecor that also do bill Medicaid for some of the counseling and other services that people receive while they're at the rehab.
Shoshana, were you able to talk to Senecor or any of the other centers you profiled? How did they defend their methods?
I think a lot of people believe that work, that instilling a work ethic in people with substance abuse disorders will cure their problem. But what we found time and again, including among the programs that tout really high success rates, is that these programs don't work for most people who go through them. I was able to get graduation rates and attendance rates for a number of the programs that we surveyed for this reporting. And it showed that most people do not actually make it to the end of these programs. Most people either drop out, they're kicked out, they relapse. And what we see time and again, especially after someone who's been abusing drugs has had a long period of abstinence, once they leave and use heroin again, for example, they're at a much higher risk of deadly overdose. So literally going to one of these programs can potentially increase your risk of death.
How legal is this system of putting people to work for little to no pay through rehab treatment, Shoshana?
There's a federal law called the Fair Labor Standards Act that requires employers to pay minimum wage and overtime to employees. And the Department of Labor has actually found on numerous occasions that these types of programs violate federal labor law. But what we also found is that the Department of Labor time and again has basically withered under pressure from rehab programs, from politicians, and withdrawn investigations into these types of programs. Back in the 90s, the Department of Labor actually found that the Salvation Army was violating the Fair Labor Standards Act. The Salvation Army runs about 100 rehab programs across the U.S., and they require participants to work at thrift stores without pay. And at the time, the Department of Labor told the Salvation Army, you need to start paying workers minimum wage and overtime for their work in the thrift stores. The Salvation Army refused. They filed a preemptive lawsuit. They got lawmakers involved in pushing back, and the Department of Labor backed down. And now there basically is a non-enforcement position at the Department of Labor with regards to the Salvation Army. There's actually a section in the handbook for investigators saying they're required to get permission before looking into pay issues at Salvation Army rehab programs.
Hmm. Okay, well, we have to take a short break, but there's a lot more to talk about here. We're speaking with Shoshana Walter, lead reporter, and Laura Starcheski, reporter and producer for the new podcast, American Rehab. I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A.
These days, Chelsea Handler tries to keep her and her friend's white privilege in check.
She starts, like, really getting weepy, and I was like, well, what are you doing right now? You just said you read White Fragility. You cannot talk about reading White Fragility and start to cry.
Comedian Chelsea Handler on white privilege and a new book. Listen to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
This is 1A. Returning now to our conversation about rehab centers across America using their patients for unpaid labor. And we got this email from Marsha in Virginia, who writes, I managed the Office of Administration in Phoenix House in New York City in the late 1980s. It had some very bizarre tactics and techniques that I believe were rooted in Synanon. It seemed cruel and reckless to me. How widespread have these practices gotten, Laura, when we look at rehab centers that maybe have a direct line to Synanon, but also ones that don't? Has this just become part of how people think substance abuse should be treated?
It's interesting that she wrote in about Phoenix House. Phoenix House is one of the direct descendants of Synanon as well, just like Senecor. But I do want to point out that even programs that carried forward those abusive tactics, a lot of them have left them behind by this point. Even if they hung on to them for a decade or two, thankfully they turn to more caring, compassionate, and proven treatment for addiction. But I think that in some ways the horse was out of the barn, in the early 70s and throughout the 70s when a lot of these spin-offs came into being. Synanon directly spawned hundreds of rehabs, and those rehabs spawned other rehabs. And so I think, you know, it's interesting with addiction treatment. I think I have a lot of people in my circle of friends and family who have been through different kinds of addiction treatment. And a lot of it's that kind of person-to-person sharing and support, like what we hear about with AA, someone having a sponsor. And I think what tends to happen is that treatment methods can also be passed along that way. If you went through a program and maybe it did end up working for you, like we said, because of the lack of regulation, it's not hard to go and start another program. Now, what might have worked for you could be harmful and really not end up helping a lot of other people. But you would be allowed to start a rehab in the image of whatever you felt worked.
We got this email from Pam in North Carolina, who writes, there's been a long history of bad practices in many of these rehab programs. Before, it was mostly Black folks attending them, and of course, these programs didn't get much attention. Now, with opioids and with white folks going to them, all of a sudden, it's an issue. Shoshana, is there something to connect there to what Pam is saying?
Absolutely. I think what originally gave rise to these programs was a lack of investment in actual addiction treatment and in treatment through our healthcare system and the criminalization of drug use. Time and time again, we saw U.S. presidents funneling more funding into arrests and incarceration than in treatment for drug users. I mean, in 1980, about 41,000 people were incarcerated for drug offenses. By 2017, it's 453,000 people who are incarcerated for drug offenses. And with the rise of substance addiction and the rise of mass incarceration, these programs have really come to represent one of the few options for people who need addiction treatment, who are desperate for addiction treatment, and who may not have health care, may not have financial resources or family support to afford anything evidence-based or better.
This has been a three-year project, but I imagine your reporting isn't done quite yet. Shoshana, what are you still watching?
We're still continuing to gather more programs. There are so many more like this out there. The 300 facilities that we were able to find is just the tip of the iceberg. because most of these programs are unlicensed and unregulated, they're not required to report information publicly. And so it's really incumbent upon people who've gone through these programs, people who've worked for these programs, to step forward and let us know that there are more out there, and we'll be following up.
That's Shoshana Walter, lead reporter for American Rehab. Also with us, Laura Starcheski, reporter and producer for American Rehab. Thanks to you both for coming on the show today. We got this email from Roy, who writes, as a board-certified addiction psychiatrist, it's terribly disappointing, but not entirely surprising, to learn how widespread these practices are. They are antithetical to the science-based, ethical, humane approaches that exist and continue to evolve. Anyone can find links to legitimate treatment resources through the SAMHSA.gov website, the American Academy of Addiction Psychiatry, and American Society of Addiction Medicine. Roy, thanks for those resources. This conversation was produced by Michelle Harvin and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again soon. This is 1A.